just wanted to start where you ended, when you spoke about NAM having a desk somewhere and teachers' union and nurses and so on international. I think the point I wanted to raise was what you raised also about the synergy which Mr. Stone is talking about. How do you influence the international civil society with those desks? And what message are you actually carrying within those desks? Because when you look at those desks in South Africa, you find a lot of contradictions in terms of where do we go? Economic policies, social policies, political policies, cultural policies, there's a lot of contradictions. Now, if they are going to export the contradictions, then they are not going to be effective. It's okay they are holding the desks, but how do they influence that international civil society in terms of our own beliefs as a people? The other point is, you also spoke about the state, the role of the state. Now, I wasn't sure now whether we have a case of a chicken and egg here. Who would take what? Is it the state or should it be the citizenry? Because there's also an argument that the state exists, you see, for the economic, social, cultural, and political well-being of the citizens, which means the citizenry has to dictate the agenda for the state. Now, I'm not quite sure, because you came very strongly on the state must do this. The state must do this. The other point that you made was on the transformation of the global government. And you made an example with the U.S. Foreign policies. But you also mentioned terrorism and communism and say, how do you pursue those? Now, remember, if you move from Roosevelt, Truman, Eisenhower, up to Kennedy, you're going to find that they were pursuing communism as an ideology. They did not equate that with the state. The only person who came to equate that with the state was the Bush Doctrine, which you spoke about. If you take Iraq, the other foreign policy could pursue terrorism as a tool throughout the world. I mean, many other countries, they were pursuing it like that. They could also relate with Russia or the Soviet Union bilaterally. But when Bush came in, to him, terrorism was equated with the state. That is why the state of Iraq was attacked. Because his equation of that tool was a state, which is different from what his predecessors did at that time. I'm sure we can also do that in South Africa. We can look at terrorism as a tool of achieving certain ideologies and maybe pursue that, but we would still relate with the states who are also proposing that. The other point that you made was on democracy. So the African agenda, which substantively then you spoke about advancing democracy, you made examples about Swaziland, Zimbabwe. I think we spoke about Zimbabwe at some point. But I think it is also a friend of the workers who also came to say that, well, democracy is also a modern day dictatorship, a new form of despotism. Unless you're careful how you deal with it, then you end up just like the others. For instance, with Swaziland, there are other options of dealing with Swaziland. I did raise this with the minister, and the minister was going to look into that. I said, with Swaziland, because of the pre-colonial traditional settings and the post-colonial traditional settings in Swaziland, you may want to have your elder statesmen in South Africa, Mr. Mandela there and the others who are more elderly, and you can even ask the others in Botswana, Lesotho, and so on, to begin dialoguing with the King of Swaziland on the questions of democracy. Because it cannot be universally said, no, these are the dictates of democracy, and therefore Swaziland has to do this. But that can be negotiated into the form of democracy we are also looking at. So to me, that could be another approach in terms of Swaziland, rather than the robust and confrontational one that we want to take. Lastly, there's also an argument, I don't know whether you agree with it, that there are some people who are looking at the emphasis of COSAT in many things, that it is also pursuing making the workers or the unemployed and the poor the reservoir of employment. It's pursuing simply workability. It has nothing to do with the people now owning, controlling, and managing the economy. But it's simply looking for work. The people must just simply work. The mentality of workerism, that's what it is pursuing. I'm not sure whether you agree with it. Lastly, Mr. Stoll, I think it's the point on SA corporations in Africa. I think in the workshop we did manage to speak about it. We even came to a point of talking about the code of conduct, which I think is taking the matter further. That there can be a platform where a code of conduct for these businesses can then be drawn, which would then be harmonized with the labor laws of principles of those countries where they are practicing, where they are having stores and things like that. Thank you.
Okay, Chairperson, I won't be long. I think, Chairperson, a few things which I've noticed.
Yes.
First of all, is this one of the feeling of integration emerged long ago during the late 80s, during the CODESA, I'm subject to correction, whereby a lot of people from the different countries in the neighboring countries wanted to be taken on board, only to find that the CODESA was for the South Africans. That's where they discussed that they reached an amicable solution that they mustn't disturb the process. Therefore, and I think we are on the right track, but the issue is this, the thing which you raise, that, I mean, from the feeling of the workers, what is the view of other workers in the neighboring countries about the very same feeling? Because there's this challenge that our good intentions are not, which you raise, that our good intentions are not measured in a good cause. Some people are having their own feeling about that one. And why I'm raising that matter is that the example which was raised by Babu Kosan about issues of Swaziland and Zimbabwe, etc., I don't think that we're speaking on the same voice. Because some workers, they can take that position which have been taken by us. But the things which contradicting about that matter is the things which were raised by which person. When I was doing some of the analysis after your input, that some of the people, they think they are on me. Therefore, I wanted to find out about the views of other workers from the other countries, the neighboring countries. Thank you, Chairperson.
Oh, thanks. Thanks, Chairperson. And thanks to honorable member. I think most of the reflection that honorable members were making are critical points. I will just add to those that I think probably need a few remarks. The first one is that I think it's true. I almost said Dr. Ben again, Dr. Skosana again. it's almost true, honorable member, that the question of exporting contradictions of civil society is true. Because, you see, there's this forum that is called the World Social Forum. The World Social Forum is supposed to be at the moment the most, I don't want to use the word representative, but it's the biggest assembly of the progressive and general civil society organization in the world at the moment. It's a loose arrangement, though. But you do find their contradiction even among South African civil society, attacking each other on the basis of the issues they are raising about economic policy. At one point in time, when we're in Kenya, or even in Brazil, because it's usually held there, the other social movement was saying, no, COSATU has no authority to speak on economic policy issues because it's in government. It's part of the alliance that is governing, they are the ones who made the laws. So I'm just saying those contradictions are true. They do happen. Just like all other forms take different forms. But I think the most important thing is the process of synergizing and finding a common position on the issues of national development without outphasing our own particular different outlook is critical. So it's a process. Because it means, how do you rally people around the particular issues systematically and consistently? They will not agree every day, but there must be common core points that you can say when you go out, this one represents all of us. We all agree on them. Because in some instances, I've noted that we don't disagree on the issues. We disagree either on personalities or structures. I say we want jobs and we are against poverty. You say the same, but the only thing you say because I'm in alliance with this one, then I'm responsible for the lack of jobs. And so, but we all agree about jobs. So I'm saying that we can be able to tie down what we call the national development agenda that we all must carry. Yes, we continue to have our own concerns. But I think what you are drawing to our attention is very important. But one thing I wanted to suggest is that in the line with the suggestion by the chairperson that I think we need an arrangement. It could be on an annual basis where civil society, foreign affairs and the department and the portfolio committee interact specifically on international work. It could be, it can become inbuilt into the portfolio's work that there is a feedback and mutual relation. So that then it takes me to the second question that you asked about who should set the agenda, is it government then taking it to civil society or the other way around? I assume it's a mutual and reciprocal relationship. But primarily, it's supposed to be the citizens who shape the agenda. Or the case. But it's supposed to be the case. But the reason why I was raising it was that, of course, it means there must be mutual feedback. Government must know what civil society is doing. And civil society must know what government is doing. So that the synergies can be drawn on the basis of our commonly understood program. So that is the first one. But the second one is that, related to that, is that I think we can, the example that I'm making is that it is a forum which can become inbuilt and can become consistent. But sometimes there are resources involved. If you say most civil society organizations are based in Johannesburg, I'm just making examples, without the intervention of the portfolio committee or government, you may not be able to have them here or in a common forum wherever it is to be able to raise their issues and engage. So it means that it's also the point that the previous speakers raised about resources that are necessary to back up that agenda. So that we are able to make it possible for them to fulfill their constitutional obligation, that is, to inform government and to engage on issues, and also opening the space necessary. So that was the point. It could be also the creative way. On the question of Swaziland specifically, one question that we've always had about Swaziland, particularly when you compare with Zimbabwe, is that the treatment is different from the other countries. Let me make an example. When Zimbabwe was kicked out of the Commonwealth during the Nigeria summit, the Secretary General of Commonwealth, not long after that, immediately went to Swaziland. He went to Swaziland because the Commonwealth has been assisting in Swaziland with the drawing up of the constitution. They've been providing technical expertise. So the constitution has been adopted. He went to stand on the podium in Swaziland and tell them that this constitution, we are proud as a Commonwealth to have associated ourselves with it, that we have built it, and so on and so forth. And then, a question was asked, you have kicked out Zimbabwe because you say there is no democracy. You say political parties are not able to function. They are not democratic elections. You have come to, you are standing on a podium, shameless, and you are promulgating a constitution that bans political parties, that does not allow political freedom, that denies those sorts of speech. By the way, even more than Zimbabwe, the only country in SADC that bans political parties legally is Swaziland. In this constitution, where they are banned, in Zimbabwe they might have problems, but only Swaziland bans them formally, legally, since 1973, and has the oldest state of emergency in the region, and I should assume in Africa, since 1973. So the point of the matter that was asked was, he then responds to the media and says, no, it's because in Swaziland we must be sensitive to the cultural realities and so on and so forth. So they say, in Zimbabwe, when Zimbabwe raises its own internal issues about sovereignty, you don't regard that. But when Swaziland raises cultural issues, you find that cultural issues have a right to sit on top of other people's rights. So there is this global hypocrisy about issues, about assumptions. So our assumption is, for instance, we're making a example that we've ran two campaigns, Swaziland and Zimbabwe, almost simultaneously. Zimbabwe was the first week of April, especially because of Swaziland. One thing we noted, the media captured everything about Swaziland, about Zimbabwe. But Swaziland, 30 people were arrested. The media did not even pay attention to that. 30 people were arrested during the same campaign, 12 April, where they were commemorating the 34 years of the state of emergency that banned political parties. So you can see that the world is only controlled by those forces that have the power. They determine which country, which issue should come first, which issue should be in the media or of interest. So, but the main point that I'm raising is that if we are saying on Zimbabwe, nothing must stand in the way of human rights, in Swaziland it must be the same. Whether it's culture, whether it's monarch, whether it's pre-colonial issues, in my view, other people can probably correct that. Our view is that nothing must stand in the way of human rights. Culture is no more important than the rights of people, the dignity of people. So nothing must be. So if we allow the abuse of women and children in the name of culture, and we still allow that to continue, it may point out certain inconsistencies. So that's why we also have been saying that even institutions, even independent institutions, have also been able to, might have not been raising the issues consistently. Because for instance, the question that was asked by one speaker in one forum was, who determines whether 1 million people who have died in Rwanda should be the issue of focus more than a certain number of people who have been arrested in Zimbabwe and Swaziland, or in Burundi, or in the... So and so on and so forth, all those things, the African agenda must clarify that. The media, or the issues, how do they get to be raised as priority issues? But of course, they're not saying human beings must be compared, that these are suffering less. Suffering human beings are suffering human beings. But the point must be made that none must be sensationalized above the other, to the extent that we then forget about the situation in other countries. So that was the point. But I think what the point of constructive recurrence is, versus the national development agenda, broadly. I'm sure that my counterparts from the policy department will be better placed. But nevertheless, I would just reflect on it to say that, relatively that could be seen. That's why I say, your intentions are not measured against what you have planned to do, but against what you are seen to be doing. But primarily I would say that our view has been, if there is a dichotomy between workers' interests and the national agenda, then there's a problem with one of them. Because we thought that a national agenda that represents the interests of all includes the interests of workers. I cannot imagine a national development agenda that does not have its priority as fighting poverty and creating jobs and decent work, and still hoping to improve the lives of people. So our engagement about the conditions of workers as our primary constituents and our immediate site of strategy is to be seen in the context where we say that is an immediate site of strategy, but primarily we are saying you cannot address the question of jobs unless you address the agrarian reform, that is land to poor people in rural areas. Because the people who move to urban areas to look for jobs are from rural areas where they don't have land. They don't have access to capital. It's the women who will not be able to sustain themselves in those cooperatives that do not have capital. If they were able to do so in those rural areas, you will not be having job business in Johannesburg. Because the people will be killing the land. So it means
The National Development Agenda must be integrating all these components in such a way that we are able. But certainly no sector must be compromised by the other. For instance, people say workers must sacrifice their jobs because we want economic growth. Then the question becomes, whose economic growth? Yes, there will be economic growth, but whose becomes the question. So because economic growth is not always for the poor, it's not given. There can't be economic growth that lifts out the poor. So the question is, how do you relate economic growth with the interest of all the poor? But of course, I know that's an ongoing macroeconomic policy debate. I was just reflecting on it. I'm sure that the constructive input by members of the House can be welcome. The last point, views of neighboring countries, workers, examples being Zimbabwean problem. I also agree with the honorable member, Mr. Sander, that on workers have got different views like everybody else. The knowledge I remember, on Zimbabwe, for instance, I have never seen the amount of divergence as the question of Zimbabwe has caused. Even among trade unions, let me remember, Namibian trade unions, for instance, they don't even want to talk about the Zimbabwe question. They say, it's clearly the work of imperialism. Full stop. You have Botswana workers fully saying that, even that land reform is not necessary. Sometimes that land reform is not necessary because it's chasing away investors. You have got all sorts of views because any sector is bound to be divergent in its views. I can imagine the same case could be women. Because my advantage is that I also participated in the youth and student movement, the African youth and student movement, before I joined the trade union movement. Such views were expressed even in those forums. So even in the trade union movement, it's the same thing. Not long ago, I think 2 weeks ago, where the ICFU Afro, here in Johannesburg, African trade union, we had a podium on Zimbabwe. Some trade unions, we have different views, even when it comes to whether we support the land redistribution process, there are different views. Whether we support this and that. So that's why I'm saying that there are discussions, including on the sovereign question. Because we must also accept the question that the question of democracy is not only a state issue. Even in civil society, there's a problem of democracy. You find leaders who have led the trade union movement since 1963. For instance, I know that the Secretary General of OASU and the Secretary General of IGFU Afro have been Secretary General since 1963. So, but that person is supposed to be leading a civil society that is the model of democracy. We are challenging government to be democratic, not to run too many terms, and so on and so on. But ourselves, a civil society, we are questionable in our habits in many instances. But in some countries, we must know, it becomes the only ticket for existence for people. The exit strategy does not exist. If, for instance, my friend, the Secretary General of ICFU Afro were to leave tomorrow, the question becomes, how does he live in his own country? It becomes a question, you will not be able to move to UN and so on and so forth. But I'm just saying, other than the exit strategy, there are issues of internal democracy in the civil society. Even in our neighboring countries. So sometimes you find a situation where, if you meet in forums and say, internal democracy must be a fair, others begin to take a taxi. Just like when South African government taxes other governments in Africa, they begin to then become worried about the fact that they're challenging their own power base. It's essential to be in civil society. So I'm just saying that I think I absolutely agree that they will be digested their views, and also they're informed by particular, sometimes narrow interests. But sometimes it might be informed by the fear. South Africa is also feared because of its size. The fact that is, others may see you as may see South Africa as a big brother. For instance, I remember that if you make this example, without taking your time, just one less example. If you say the 14 countries of the SADC community have a smaller GDP than housing as a province, that says something about the relationship. So in US, the Sutu can raise a point in a meeting. None will take it serious, or none will have a problem. South Africa raises it, or it wants to control us. It's a problem. It's expected, because the unevenness creates that skepticism, that everything you raise, there must be some agenda behind. They're not raising it on it. So I'm just saying all those are factors that complicate the matter even further. But nevertheless, the ongoing about it is that we must consolidate our agenda, we must interact with our allies, we must advance and support civil society that is advancing a progressive, developmental and democratic agenda in Africa, and we must have a closer relationship that allows mutual feedback on both sides, and also critical reflection, even critical views. I don't expect government that means it should be happy to have a view which concerns us only showers crazy. Certainly even government must also have concern about conservative views or relations internationally. So in that way, the mutual feedback will be valuable. It will not just be based on romantic notions. Not that government says we are not happy with this or the portfolio committee. But also, we also say that we are not happy with this. But on that basis, we are also able to say we agree on this. And we both must be able to commonly advance it. In that way, I'm sure that the partnership will be clearly defined, but also the role will not compromise with that, but will be able to advance what is commonly in our interest. Thanks.
Member, Mr. Masego raised that there should not be a romanticization of the relationship. I got very worried. I got extremely worried because if that ends, if the part of romance ends, then they will be doing what is biblically outlawed. God said we should marry, increase the population. And if you have a problem with that aspect, then there's going to be a problem. Members, I just want us to come to an end of this meeting by saying that maybe what we'll note in our record is to look at the possibility. You know, we did this thing last year in Pretoria, a review of South Africa's foreign policy. We had a 2-day or 3-day in Pretoria where we had a forum and we invited. Maybe we should look at another forum towards the end of the year where we bring all the stakeholders again to review the South African foreign policy and see how we contribute in shaping the views. But of course, issues of democracy, Honorable Sosana, are complicated. Somewhere it is said that the role of a trade union by its very nature is very limited. In fact, they say the trade union movement in a society in transition, plays a role that supports the transformation of society. And its duty as a vanguard movement of the workers, not of the working class, of the workers, is to support the revolutionary transformation of society and support the organization that behaves the transformation. Now, if you come back and say, what did the Zimbabwe Federation, Trade Union Federation did? Was it wrong the way it went ahead? It could be debated. I will argue that they were not wrong. They played their historical role to support the transformation. The question is how then, at some point in time, extricate themselves from being perpetually supporters of the transformation, but be able to assert the role of protecting those who are unemployed. And in doing so, Honorable Skosana, the trade union movement does not preoccupy itself really with the unemployed, because it's a representative of the employed. In engaging the employer, It's the role of the political party to organize society, whether employed or unemployed, and defend the interests of the society as a whole. And therefore, the narrowness of trade union engagement, as a textbook definition, sometimes comes at odds with our own situation, in this case, Kosatu, because it picks up social issues. But the reason why it does that, it does not do that because that is their historical role. But it does that because in terms of its own struggle against colonialism and oppression, it has to pick up political struggle to advance the liberation of the people. Once they've done that, then their role becomes very defined and limited. And in the process of transition, their primary responsibility is to support the transformation. The problem is the exit on the other end. To what extent do they end there? I don't know. That goes with issues of democracy. It is argued that as human beings, we have defined democracy in relation to us being able to go to elections every 5 years. And therefore we are democratic. In that respect, Zimbabwe is democratic. Irrespective of all the weaknesses that are there, is democratic. And therefore, as we define Zimbabwe as being undemocratic, when you talk about formal democracy, Dr. Zohar, when you talk about formal democracy, Zimbabwe conforms to all the tenets of formal democracy. It's the actual democracy that is an issue, not the formal part. And all of us, except of course the very few, if they're still there, go to an extent of actual democracy. But all of us are formal democracies. We are all formal democracies. South Africa itself, we can pride ourselves in all other respects, but we are just a formal democracy. We go to elections every 5 years, and we pronounce that as democratic. It's the masses that are able to transform the state to actual democracy. That's what they tell us. That's what the textbook tell us, Doctor. We don't know. Those who are learned are able they are able to explain it further. But it's quite a very complicated situation. But at some point in time, when do we decide that the struggle of any country is only a struggle of human rights and all other things are not an issue, the human rights issue? I do not believe that any struggle that any society engages in is purely a struggle that only concerns itself with human rights. Human rights are a component of the struggle. It's not the totality. It's a component. But every time when we deal with these issues of political problems, everything gets reduced to human rights. Nothing else but human rights. And to me, that becomes an issue. And the question, therefore, is how do we relate with it as politicians? How do we engage with these issues? Do we believe that human rights is an answer for everything? We can have human rights, but it may not be liberated. Your rights could be respected. Your rights could be respected, but that does not translate into your total freedom, your total liberation. In fact, it's proven in history that colonialism promoted certain groups in societies to be able to control the others. And those who were promoted enjoyed the privilege of their rights being given and their rights being protected. They had the right to go to school, they had the right to participate in the political establishment. To an extent that you do not threaten the existence of the colonizer, your rights are protected. And therefore that class became the class that actually at the end oppress the whole society on behalf of the colonial master. So, I mean, those are the issues that, and that's why I would always argue that it's not true that the struggle is all about one aspect of it. Human rights is one aspect of the struggle. It's not the total. In Zimbabwe, human rights might be an issue, but can we reduce the whole revolution to only that aspect and argue, correctly or wrongly, that everything is lost? Maybe not. And the question, therefore, is the contestation of our perspective on international relations. How do we understand it? How do we relate with it? Globalization, as we understand it, is it what everybody understands, or is it in fact a contested terrain, and therefore our conduct of international relations should also reflect how we understand the relations among states, among nations, and what is it that at different point in time wants to be achieved, and how then do you coordinate your own forces in the country to be able to articulate the developmental agenda that we're talking about? Because unless you do that, you'll not be able to mobilize your maximum opinion in the country. Honorable members, the sickness of politics is that we can go the whole night. I was just playing with, but you know, the good thing. It's a reference point. I was just making a reference. But honorable members, we are convening tomorrow at 10. We hope that we will then be able to round off this presentation. And members will remember that all these things are going towards the preparation for the budget debate on the 29th. The critical issue being, how do other people understand our foreign policy as we understand them, so that when we debate, we are able to pick up some of the issues and the weaknesses that have been identified in how we understand that. And I see that a number of presenters today were a little bit shy to raise the weaknesses of the portfolio committee. Instead, they all shifted everything else and blame it on the department. And none of them was quite keen to say, but these are weaknesses of the portfolio committee. Okay, the meeting's better there.